Hi, welcome to Measure the Metric, a podcast about engineering monuments, the people who built them, and the people who used them. My name is Vivian Yu.
And my name is John Julius.
I'm a civil engineer.
And I'm married to a civil engineer.
Every episode, we're going to pick one engineering monument. Maybe it's ancient, or maybe it's brand new, from somewhere in the world.
We're going to tell you about what it is, what it does, who built it, and how it was built.
So today we're going to talk about the Kansai Airport. This is the airport that you most likely fly into if you're visiting Osaka, Japan.
Okay.
It's a super cool project. I think all airport projects are mega projects in their own right, but researching this one sucked.
Yeah. So just like a thing. So Vivian is incredibly smart and she's also very well-rounded, but I have never heard her complain so much about just like not understanding concepts as you did during this. And I mean, never, like not at any point in our relationship have you complained as much about having to learn something as you did during the research for this podcast. So this is going to be an interesting one, guys. Buckle up.
Okay. So a little context. I specialize in mostly linear infrastructure, which means infrastructure that goes across huge swaths of land. So far we've done the sewers, the Roman highways, and the canal. Those are all linear projects because they go from point A to point B.
Yeah.
So an airport, the other stream, these are vertical infrastructure and it's not my jam. Yeah.
Well, and that's totally understandable. I mean, the other thing too is that a lot of why this is so impressive has to do with how they handled specific types of clay.
Yeah.
So anyways, it's going to be super interesting. So I hope. Buckle up.
It's going to be interesting watching me stumble anyway.
Yes.
Okay. So the Kansai Airport, it's super cool because it was the first airport to be built on reclaimed land. So, John, you know what reclaimed land is?
So, reclaimed land is when, in this context, and in most contexts, mm-hmm. it's when it's you have, say, a lake or an ocean or a river or something like that, and you fill it up with dirt, and then you build stuff on top of that dirt.
Yeah.
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 So, for instance, we live in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and I know that a lot of Toronto downtown is actually reclaimed land, right?
A lot of the waterfront has been reclaimed. Yeah.
So this is near and dear to our home and our hearts. It's, you could say,
very far. It's in Japan.
No, but the concept.
So the concept is, yes, that we basically build new land to build on. So this is a stream of civil engineering that has to deal with earth or soil, and it's called geotechnical engineering.
Yes.
And I have to this day no idea how I passed.
Okay.
That course, it was, yeah. But I remember distinctly the final exam were 6 questions and 2 of which I had no idea, and I just wrote things. I just, like, you know, you remember every single formula that you can and you wrote them all down and hope that one of them was what the prof was looking for.
Okay.
And I came out of that exam with just barely a pass, like just right. A Hail Mary, barely a pass.
Okay.
So geotech is not my jam. Most geotechnical engineers have a master's degree or a PhD, which you ask any other engineer and they're going to tell you a PhD is a waste of time. Like, that's my favorite part of Big Bang Theory, is that Howard doesn't have a PhD.
Yeah, yeah. I have a master's degree, right? That whole joke. It's been a long time since I've seen that show.
But. Yeah. Engineers don't get PhDs unless you want to stay in academia.
Right.
But geotechnical engineers do. So, yes, we're going to talk about geotech. And part of the story has to do with the fact that you don't really know what a ground condition is like or is going to be like.
Okay.
Once you've tested it and once you've disturbed the ground to try to figure out its properties, once you've disturbed it, it's already changed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, yes.
So it's a lot of estimation. It's a lot of theoretical modeling, hoping that if you build a bridge on top of this ground, that it's going to stand. Hoping that if you build an airport on top of this ground, that it's going to stand.
Right. Okay. So a hope and a prayer. See, you guys thought that this was going to be a boring episode, but buckle up. It's going to be great. Please, please keep listening.
Okay. So it's going to be interesting because Kansai Airport, like I said, is the first airport that's built on reclaimed land. And now we see a lot more airports being built in that same sense, right?
Right.
A lot of airports in Asia, in Hong Kong, a lot of apartment buildings. If you look at those impressive looking islands in Dubai, mm-hmm. that's all reclaimed land.
Right.
So it really kind of set the precedence for this type of work.
Sure.
But also because it was really the first of its type, this might be our first What Went Wrong episode.
All right. Awesome.
A little bit of engineering fail.
Yeah. So that's good. All right. All right. So get into it.
Okay. So the Kansai Airport, it is in Osaka Bay.
Okay.
So it is within a bay area. It opened in 1994.
Right.
So this is fairly recent.
Yeah. I was six.
Yeah.
At the time. I think Kurt Cobain died that year in and around there somewhere. So
thanks for the context. Yeah. Yes.
Context, North American context. I don't know what was happening in Japan outside of the Kansai Airport.
Well, let me tell you, in the 1960s, Tokyo Airport and Osaka International Airport were getting quite busy. There was kind of an economic boom and there was a lot more just visiting of that area and they were being overwhelmed with traffic and demand. So there was definitely a need for a much bigger airport. Mm-hmm. Now, the question, of course, is where to build this, because as we all know, Japan is a series of small islands mm-hmm. and there's just not much land to go around. Yep. When they constructed Narita Airport, which is in Tokyo, they did it through expropriation of lands and it led to some serious violent protests. So after that, the government basically said, we can't do that again for this.
Right.
So what could they do? Well, let's just build new land in mm-hmm. the bay.
Just create it.
Yeah. It would need to avoid expropriation and noise pollution because people were just really upset when Narita Airport was built.
Yeah. And so expropriation is when you take somebody and you kick them out of their home.
Yeah. And you compensate them. But
you give them money, but they lose their home. Yeah.
Exactly. And sometimes it's very unfair, especially if you only need like a parcel of someone's land. So you can maybe like take their backyard mm-hmm. and only pay for the backyard. But obviously someone's property is like completely changed if you take their backyard, right? You can't just really expropriate a portion of land, but sometimes the government does anyway.
Sure. Okay. Cheap.
It's a very, touchy subject of infrastructure development.
Yeah.
Okay. So this airport took 20 years to plan. Demand was started in the 60s. It didn't open until 1994. It took quite a while to get there. It took $14 billion to construct.
Is that today's dollars or?
Well, the 90s, like 1990s.
90s yen.
$14 billion US dollars to construct.
Right. That's a lot of money in the 90s.
Yeah. And an additional $6 billion because of expansions and fixing it.
Right.
So there's still ongoing investments to fix it and keep it above water.
There you go. Quite literally.
It's the third busiest airport in Japan today.
Okay.
It's on an entirely man-made island that's connected to the mainland by a 3.7 kilometer bridge. So this is the only way to get from the mainland to the island.
Right. And so 3.7 kilometer bridge is that's a pretty solid bridge.
It's a pretty long bridge. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that's a long, you think about walking 3 kilometers, that takes a little while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'll take you about half an hour or so. Yeah.
I think probably even more than that.
So yeah, it's a pretty long bridge and it's the only connection to the mainland. It's got road traffic on top and it's got train undercarriage. It is also the longest terminal in the world. So if you think of an airport nowadays, like when I think of an airport, a typical airport, it's got like a terminal in the middle and then spokes coming out of it. That's where like airplanes would dock. sure. or park, right? Like that's what you kind of think of is
yeah.
these arms that come out of the terminal where yeah. the airplanes would park into.
Yeah.
Kansai Airport is one long terminal. So it's just one long linear thing that airplanes just park against.
Right. Okay. And so what impact does that have on somebody who's like trying to catch a flight? Does that mean like you arrive at the train station and you've got a straight line
yeah.
to get to your flight? Okay.
Yeah. It's 4 kilometers long.
That's dumb. They've got like people movers yeah, and stuff.
Of
yeah.
Of course.
That's still dumb. I can't imagine having to go 4 kilometers. Imagine you're like running late for your flight.
Yeah. So that's one of the features. And that was part of the architect's design. It's built by a famous architect. His last name was Piano. I should have written it down. I mean, this is an engineering podcast. It's not about architects. So anyway.
Sorry, Mr. Piano. not getting your appropriate credit.
Yeah, I will get into some of the interesting things that architecturally they did. Yeah, so longest terminal in the world, first offshore airport in the world. It has a pet hotel. Out of all my research of like what this thing has, my favorite thing is a pet hotel.
Yeah, and so this would be like you have to catch a flight, but you're going to be home in a few days and you just drop off your pets.
Yeah.
And they're thinking, that's great.
They get their little room. They have like a little dog run. It's got like air conditioning. And they got
lovely.
So cute. Anyway, yeah. Okay. All right. So building this airport, I'm going to go from the ground up literally. Okay.
Okay.
The soil in the bay is mostly Holocene clay.
Okay.
So it's submerged clay. And yes. the first thing you have to do whenever you build something on top of water or ground, you have to compact it. But the thing with clay is that it's not like a sponge. Like if you squeeze it, it won't necessarily just squeeze out water.
Right.
So it takes time and it will warp as it drains.
Lovely.
As opposed to sand. Sand is great because you can compact it and then there will be no water.
Yeah. Oh, here's a question. How would you go about compacting something that's at the bottom of a bay?
In the same way you would compact anything that's above ground, you would just drop weights on it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like sheer force.
Yeah. That makes sense.
They wanted to be able to compact this clay quickly without it taking super long time and without building the airport on top and having it slowly warp. And settle, because settlement is a big issue. Because ideally what you would have is a layer of sand in between the clay. Because that way, when you push on the clay, the water will come out of the clay, go into the sand and drain out. The sand would basically act like a drain.
Sure.
But there is no sand in this ground. So what did they do? They injected sand.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So they drilled sand drains like little pockets a meter in
right
at pretty close intervals all around this clay, and then they push down on the clay so that ideally the water in the clay would kind of squeeze out sideways into these sand drains and then come out.
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense.
Okay.
It's very clever. I'm gonna give them credit for that because I like it.
You like it?
Yeah. That's a good idea.
Okay. So that's how they basically try to compact the first top layer of clay. And this is as much clay as they can really know what to deal with. There is an additional layer of different types of clay underneath it, and they didn't quite account for what that would do. We had never really built anything significant on that type of clay before. And so they made some estimates about how it would behave. And I mean, most engineers don't do this, but they took the least conservative value for that settlement of that lower level clay
yeah.
and just hoped for the best.
Right. So the least conservative, they use like a worst case scenario.
They use the best case scenario.
Oh, they use the best case scenario? Oh my goodness. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So there were a bunch of civil engineers that did a bunch of calculations and modeling. They extracted some of the clay and tried to deal with it in the lab. But obviously, lab conditions is not going to be the same. Because like I said, once you've disturbed the clay, you've disturbed the clay.
Yeah.
It doesn't behave the same way anymore.
Right.
So they took that clay, they worked with it in the labs, they came up with some values of how fast they think it would settle under pressure. And of course, they give a range, right? Because we're not idiots. We're not going to give you like 5.
No, yeah, of course. But still, I mean, we're talking about they hope for the best and prepare for the best.
Yes. Yeah. So that's what they did.
Okay.
I mean, that was part of the, I think, political decision as well, because it was already a very expensive project.
Yeah, of course.
So to take a more conservative value would have been very expensive.
Yeah, you're adding. Okay. But no, I'm sticking to my guns here. That's dumb.
Yeah. It became more expensive in the end.
Yeah. There you go. Learn your lesson, politicians.
But anyway, the first layer of clay, and they've done monitoring since, it worked really well with the sand drains. That thing settled as much as they expected, and it has not settled since. Right. So the problems that we have now is from the ground that was underneath it that nobody knew what would happen.
Okay.
After they drilled these sand drains into the clay, they added a layer of sand on top, and they filled it with these little concrete tripod shaped things.
Okay.
Do you remember jacks?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Kind of like a 4-pronged, 6-pronged metal thing. And
yeah.
It would be on the ground and you had to bounce a ball and then you had to grab as many as you could.
Yeah.
And if you stepped on them, then you'd bleed. It sucked.
I don't think they were metal. I think they were rubber. Anyway, okay.
I had metal ones. Growing up in the prairies.
So they had a bunch of these concrete, kind of oddly shaped tripod things that they put on top of each other, and they stacked a bunch of them because they were stable, right? They're tripods.
Yeah, yeah.
But it allowed movement between them. Okay. Do you understand?
Why would you want movement between them? That's the part I can envision what this looks like. And then you stack them up.
Mm-hmm.
You want movement for like water between them, or?
Well, what kind of weather condition does Japan get?
Oh, they get earthquakes.
And the tsunamis.
And the tsunamis, yes.
Yeah. So one of the big things about protecting and building for earthquakes and tsunamis is that you don't want to build a rigid structure, right? A rigid structure has no flexibility and it won't absorb energy, because ultimately earthquakes and tsunamis are just extreme amounts of energy.
Okay.
So you want to build a structure that will be able to absorb that energy. And part of that is allowing movement while maintaining stability.
Right. Okay.
So these tripods of concrete that sit at the bottom of the bay and make up the foundation of the airport, they allow wave movements and tsunamis to basically go around.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Pretty clever, right?
Pretty clever. Yeah. I'll give them some credit for that. Again, 1 point back after the bottom clay fiasco.
Yeah, so that's pretty interesting. And then, of course, they did allow for some amount of settlement because they knew that it was going to settle a little bit. The question was how much.
Yeah, yeah.
And part of the problem is also uneven settlement. Right, because your ground is not uniform everywhere. Your loading is not uniform everywhere. So some parts of the ground might settle faster than others.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty big deal for a runway, because what happens when you have roads that start moving or settling? They crack.
Yeah, you get these big potholes.
Yeah. And usually airport runways are concrete based. But this one was paved with asphalt because asphalt has oil and it allows flexibility.
Right.
A warp. And it's easier to patch than concrete.
Yeah. Okay. So that makes sense.
Okay. So also to deal with the uneven settlement, because you're going to have this major structure, which is this like long ass terminal, they installed jacks under each column of the structure. Okay.
Okay.
So the jacks compensate as each column might settle differently.
Yeah.
to make sure that they're always level.
That's pretty cool.
Do you understand?
No.
It's basically like, you know what a jack is, right? It's something that lifts your car when you're trying to change a tire.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's a mechanical thing that, sorry.
Okay. So we're no longer talking about the tripod things.
No.
This is a pneumatic jack.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
We're at ground level now. So we went from clay to sand to the concrete tripod things. And now we've built up and now we're on ground level. We talked about the pavement.
Yes.
And now we're at the building. We're at the terminal.
Okay, cool. Perfect. That makes so much sense.
Okay. So at the terminal, if you have uneven settlement, your columns of your building might settle unevenly and then it might collapse. It might damage the structural integrity of the building, right?
Yep.
So rather than allowing that to happen, they installed jacks underneath each of the columns so they can actually control how much each of the column would settle. And this is important because given the additional amount of settlement that they didn't anticipate, these jacks actually allow them to remediate the terminal and kind of backfill.
Right.
And lift up the building artificially.
Yeah. Cool.
So they can lift them up, fill it under, and then put more dirt underneath the jacks, basically, and lift it up some more and then brilliant. Reset.
It doesn't get any better than that, really.
I mean, it's pretty clever, but it also, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a Band-Aid solution.
Yeah. But hey, I mean, it is 1994, right? The Band-Aids. You got the... I don't know.
Okay. I don't know where you were going with that.
I don't know where I was going with that either. This is all very confusing to me, so I'm doing my best.
I'm sorry. This is a lot of technical. Are you following?
It's not hugely technical. It's a lot to envision.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, here's something also interesting. Remember I said if you have uneven loading on the island, you're going to have uneven settlement as well, right?
Yeah.
So that means that all these little buildings that they built on the island, because it's not just the terminal, you also have control centers, you also have additional terminals and et cetera, right? They have maintenance buildings and whatnot.
Yeah.
All the buildings need to be kind of spread out and weighed equally.
Oof.
In some sense, yeah?
Yeah.
And so the main terminal has a huge basement, right? The basement is used for all sorts of things like storage or baggage claim or baggage movement. Like there's a million reasons why an airport might have a huge basement.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about it, a basement actually makes the building lighter, or it makes the island lighter, because rather than having that area be filled with dirt, it's now filled with air.
Right.
So now you've lowered the density of this thing that's floating, right? So when you lower the density of something that's floating, it's going to change its loading on the ground.
Okay. Yeah.
So what they had to do was actually line the basement with iron, just solid iron.
Awesome.
To add weight to this thing and compensate.
Right. So that's adding more cost to this project that was already too expensive for the politicians, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of compromises going on.
It's a balancing act, right? There's a lot of different priorities. There's a lot of different things that you have to think about when you're building this airport on a completely different environment that you wouldn't have to think about on just good old dry land.
Sure.
So that's interesting. You know, this basement is now basically bomb-proof.
Nice.
It's everything-proof. It's earthquake-proof. It's tsunami-proof. It's
x-ray-proof.
X-ray-proof. That's true. Yeah. There you go.
Although if they lined it with iron, it's not rust-proof, is it? Ha-ha. Unless they galvanized it. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't think they just like expose it to seawater. That would seem stupid to me.
It would seem stupid.
Anyway. To build the island itself, they started by constructing the seawalls. So if you actually look at pictures of the progression of the construction of this thing, it was like a coloring book where they built the outline with a wall.
Okay.
And then just filled it in with dirt.
Nice.
Yeah. And most of that fill came from actually three nearby mountains. They basically leveled some mountains.
Okay. Seems to be a noble engineering pursuit.
Yeah.
Tearing down these mountains.
Yeah. We just like to, you know, even things out.
Bend the land to your whim.
Right. So there was some risk of earthquakes threatening to liquefy the fill material and destabilize the foundation. Because one of the things that energy can do is it kind of makes dirt behave like a liquid, just the way that it's shaken.
Yeah.
That was one of the risks to this airport. But obviously, they did a lot of things to try to temper that out. And 15 months after the airport opened in 1995, it suffered a major earthquake, but there was minimal damage. So kind of prove that the engineers did their job for the most part.
That's
in that
good.
Sense.
Good for them.
Yeah. So they backfilled that seawall area with a lot of large boulders and rocks to resist the liquefaction.
Cool.
There are also in the terminal, and I think this is more of the architects doing, but there are sliding joints in the structural frame of the walls.
Right.
So it's not rigidly nailed to each other, right?
Yeah.
All the joints allow lateral movement, which absorbs earthquake energy.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the roof is actually not specifically fixed to the walls.
Right.
So even though if you look at pictures of this terminal, it's got huge windows from like floor to ceiling. The wall, basically the glass, is not affixed to any rigid part of the structure. And so in an earthquake, it does not shatter. It doesn't absorb energy.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. So all the energy is absorbed by the joints, by allowing movement, little bits of movement.
Nice.
Now, I've never really been in a building that's been earthquake proof during an earthquake. But like in my mind, of course, as an engineer, I'm thinking like the whole building moves and it's fine. But realistically, it could be pretty minimal how much the building moves because it doesn't need to move a significant amount to really absorb that energy, right? It just
right.
needs to allow movement so that you're not shearing off parts of your nails or your joints or your bolts.
Yeah, because if you think about how many pieces go into a building, having something move even by like an inch could be enough to destroy anything that's less than an inch thick or else it can like twist or anything like that. A building doesn't have to move a ton in order to really cause some problems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, when you're building IKEA furniture and it's so rigid, right? All the things are so rigid.
Ideally.
And then you like tighten the screw way too much as well. But like in the end, it all loosens and there's not a single thing you could do about it.
Yeah.
Right? Because you use it, you move it, and it loosens. And it's not to do with the fact that it's not tight enough. It's to do with the fact that it's actually too tight and it doesn't allow movement so that when you're sitting on the chair and you put your energy loading and you move around on it, it shears off all the connections.
Yeah.
So in the same way as a building.
Well, there you go.
The roof is actually quite interesting. So the roof of this long terminal is designed to be like an airplane wing foil.
Okay. So for the wind?
Yes. The idea of a wing foil or a foil is that if you have different pressure, right, in different parts of the foil, whether it's above or below, it's going to move air differently and at different speeds.
Yes. So just to break that down a little bit more for anyone who's not familiar with this concept, because I understand this one.
Yeah.
So you have a wing and it's straight on the bottom and it's curved over the top. And so then what happens is that the air comes over and the air going underneath the wing doesn't get slowed down, but the air going over top of the wing has to account for this curve, right? And so you wind up with this difference in pressure where the pressure below the wing is higher than the pressure above the wing because the air is moving faster and then that lifts up the plane. Ha ha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So with the roof, one of the things that they do was use the same principle, but they didn't want the roof to fly off. That's not what they wanted.
No.
What they did though is push the air across the terminal so that they didn't need to actually install a manual HVAC system.
Oh, wow.
So pretty incredible. An HVAC, sorry, is, I don't even know what that stands for.
It's something vacuum air conditioning.
It's basically a ventilation system.
Yeah.
Yeah, for your house to make sure that air is moving and that nobody's suffocating and that you get clean air all the time.
That's right.
So the roof, it's very high up and you can't quite see it, but it's got an opening to the outside. And by virtue of the shape of the roof acting like a foil, it pushes air from the back of the terminal to the front all on its own.
Okay, that's pretty cool. Oh, is it? I think it's heating, vacuum, air conditioning, or heating, ventilation, air conditioning. It's HVAC.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's moving air around the building in an enclosed space.
There you go.
But this allows natural airflow, and it's also just a really pretty looking roof. It's nice. Very artistic, and they also use a mathematical modeling system.
Okay.
So that this 4 kilometer sheet of foil basically could be standardized into 82,000 steel panels that are absolutely identical.
Oh, wow.
Right. So this thing put together has different warps and shapes and whatnot, but in its modular form is 82,000 exact same pieces.
Very clever.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's some real ingenuity right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was done by the architect, so I'll give credit where credit is due.
Yeah. This person that you don't even know.
No, I'm pretty sure his last name is Piano. He's a famous architect. It's a big, big deal. Okay, so those are the ingenuity, the innovations, the cool success stories of this airport, right? How it was built, how did they get it done? And in the end, it was named one of 10 civil engineering monuments of the millennium by the American Society of Civil Engineers. So even though there are problems with it, it's still winning awards.
Right. Pretty impressive.
Right. But now let's get to what's going on today.
So before we do that, I just looked him up. The architect, apparently his name is Renzo Piano.
Right.
Yes. And he's a very well-respected architect. Some of his notable buildings include the Shard in London.
Oh, right. That thing.
Yeah. And the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York City. He also did the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Cultural Center in Athens. So he's around the world. This guy does a lot of buildings all over the place. Good for him.
That's
Sounds
great.
Like he did a great job.
Yeah. This is Renzo an engineering Piano. Podcast.
Credit where credit's due. All right. On with the podcast.
On with the podcast. Someone else is welcome to do an architect podcast.
We gotta mention this guy. If he engineered 82,000 identical panels.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so issues today. So like I said, the in situ settlement, so in situ meaning it's still in the ground, still in its environment. It did not match the lab conditions and the experiments. Engineers basically designed the island based on the assumption that settlement would subside in 50 years.
Okay.
They estimated it to settle 8 meters in 45 years. Okay. 8 meters in 45 years.
Yeah.
It's pretty slow. It's a lot of settlement, but what actually happened was it settled 8 meters in 5 years.
Oh, geez.
Right. So 1/9 of the time.
Yeah.
The Holocene clay that made up the first 20 meters of the seabed, this was normal clay that could be consolidated, which is what the sand drains did. And this forced that top layer of clay to reach its maximum settlement before construction of the island. That's very important. But below it is the Pleistocene clay. And this is hardened clay.
Yeah.
It is like petrified clay.
Oh, geez.
And it's got soft sand and uneven drainage layers sort of interspersed in between. So you've got these random, like unreliable layers of sand, but not uniformly. Because if it was uniformly, then you know that it would drain out of the sand.
Yeah.
Right. There would be a path, but it wasn't. It was kind of almost like these air pockets between really hard, petrified clay.
That sounds miserable and difficult to predict.
Exactly. They had never built islands on Pleistocene ground before. No one could predict how much it would settle or when the settlement would even end. So they estimated that it would settle about 5 to 10 meters, and they used the lower end of the estimate. In reality, it has sunk 13 meters as of 2016 and continues to settle at 50 centimeters per year.
Oh, geez.
So there's no idea when this would even end. It's not quite slowing down. It's not speeding up. It's just very unpredictable.
Yeah.
And like I said, they use the jacks to level out the uneven settlement, to lift the building out of the flood zone, backfilling with additional material to compensate for the oversettlement.
Cool.
Yeah. So that's kind of our first.
Yeah. We didn't do such a great job there.
But I mean, I don't think it's necessarily the engineer's fault. There was no idea of how this would settle. There was just no precedence. There was no research. And the lab research that they did couldn't be relied on. And they didn't know that.
Sure.
So I would say that there was maybe just not enough of a factor of safety there.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, more of a political and economic decision.
Okay. Okay. So, you know, I'm apologizing for the engineers a little bit here, but I think the important thing too, probably above everything else, is that they did have a method for accounting, even though this was so much more than they expected.
Yeah.
It's something that they built in a safeguard so that they can work on it, right? So good for them.
It's expensive to remediate, but there are methods of remediation that keeps the airport operational.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very important.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to talk about is a little bit of the disaster response. I've gone through a lot about how the design has been done to prevent damage from earthquakes and damage from typhoons, but it's not 100%.
Okay.
So in 2018 of September, and you'll remember this.
I do.
Typhoon Jebi hit Japan, and this is more of a Swiss cheese disaster. Have you heard of that?
No, explain.
Okay. So a Swiss cheese disaster is very much where a lot of things had to fall. And so if you imagine that your first line of defense against the earthquake is something, but there's obviously a flaw in it. And so that's a hole, like a Swiss cheese. And then your next, you know, backup plan has another hole, and you have your next backup plan, that's a hole. And if all those holes line up in your Swiss cheese sandwich, then you get a massive failure.
Gotcha. Okay. That's a cute mental image of something really bad happening.
So this is basically what happened. This typhoon hit the airport, and one of the first things that happened was it blew a massive tanker into the bridge that connects the mainland to the island. And this bridge, like I said before, is the only connection. It's almost 4 kilometers long, and it's been taken out in the middle of the storm by a tanker.
Yeah. So it wasn't the storm that took out the bridge. It was just like a boat got blown into the bridge.
Yeah.
Bad news.
Bad news. So your first Swiss cheese. Now there's no transportation. The bridge also being the only connection to the mainland is not just for the transport of vehicles. It's for the transport of electricity, of telecommunication, of natural gas. All those utilities run inside bridges.
Oh no.
So now those have been taken out. Water mains, right? So now the airport has no electricity. It now has no water. It now has no telecommunication.
So I just want to point out that that is an awful lot. So this is a busy harbor. Like, there's boats going through here. The concept of a boat getting blown into the bridge is by no means a foreign concept, right? So to have all of that, I don't know if I would consider that a Swiss cheese disaster.
Oh, this is only the first slice of cheese.
Oh, no.
This okay. is what I'm talking
continue,
about.
Continue.
Okay. So now you've got 8,000 passengers on the island that's stranded without any of those services that I just named, yeah. without any way of getting off the island.
Okay. Not good.
The disaster response center and the power generators are supposed to kick in if there's no power. Yeah?
Yeah.
And typically, disaster response centers and power generators, where do you normally find those in a building?
I would guess in the basement.
Yes. So they were located in the basement where it was flooded and damaged by seawater. 3 out of the 6 generators failed.
Oh, no.
And most of Terminal 1 had no power.
And so also the iron lining also failed.
Well.
What are you going to do?
Okay, so now you have no power. And what are you supposed to do? Well, you got to pump the water out. But what powers the pumps?
It's the backup generators.
That's right. So now you can't pump the water out to get the rest of the generators going.
Yeah.
So the airport was shut down. People were stranded and there was no way out. It was kind of the perfect storm.
Sure.
It was shut down for, I think, about a week. And you'll remember just how upsetting this was because my mom was traveling at the time and she was one of the 8,000 stuck on this island.
Yeah. And your younger sister as well.
My sister as well. So my family was there. I got a 30-second phone call from a payphone where they told me their situation. There was no way for any of the authorities to bring in help, bring in rations, bring in food, bring in clean water, other than to helicopter the supplies in.
Yeah. It was pretty ridiculous.
It was, yeah, very severe. And evacuation orders were just very disorganized for at least the first 24 hours.
First 24 hours were, yeah, touch and go.
So for all the fail saves that this airport had, all of these things just came together.
Yeah. And they just completely collapsed.
Right.
Yeah.
Because if it had gotten flooded in isolation, that's fine. Someone would have come in with some other power source and pumped the water out. If the bridge had gone down, right, in a time where it wasn't flooded, well, that's fine. The backup generators would have kept things running. There were all sorts of things that could have kept this from being a total disaster, but all the holes in the slices of cheese lined up.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. It's also interesting, too, that so we always hear about, you know, these storms happening in Japan, mm-hmm. right? Or in anywhere in the world, really. And in a developed country like Japan, you always hear about these storms and you think, oh, geez, that's crazy. They'll probably have this up and running in 12 hours, right? Like, I always find I make that assumption. And what we found too, when we were just trying to figure out what was going on with your mom, is that was like the general attitude among everyone that you called. You were called the embassy and everything. And it's just like, oh, well, they get storms in Japan all the time. There's really nothing that we can do. They'll figure it out. They'll take care of it, right?
Yeah. So ultimately, the end to that story was that my family was stuck there for almost 48 hours.
Yeah, it was quite a long period of time.
With no rations, really. So you imagine an airport, there's usually a lot of amenities and there's a lot of like food around, right? But none of the stores were manned. There was no employees anywhere and none of the vending machines were working because there was no power. And so there was almost food that they couldn't access.
Yeah. And so I think, if I remember correctly, they helicoptered in rations of sushi.
In the morning. So about 24 hours after, yeah.
But then you had to line up and they only gave you one.
Yeah.
And so I think it was your mom got in line and your sister stayed and watched their bags. And your mom only wound up getting one ration that she then had to split with your sister.
But so I mean, like, knowing my family, they also bought a lot of souvenirs. They basically just cracked into them and it was fine. Nobody starved, but it was a very scary situation.
For sure.
And they evacuated the Chinese national bus because my family is Chinese, even though my sister has no Chinese passport. But my mom just told her to shut her mouth and get on the bus.
Yeah. She looks the part. She's born and raised Canadian, but she looks the part at least. So,
anyway, all of that to say, just because this is how we typically build airports, just because all our emergency services tend to be in the basement. And you're going to see this in a lot of like condos that are built in flood zones as well. Remember in Calgary when we had the major flood, a lot of the buildings lost power and lost clean water because all their generators were built in the basement, as is typical. Mm-hmm. But you can't build in a flood zone as though you would on dry land. Yeah. And I think that's one of those really important lessons that we're still learning. It doesn't make sense to build emergency services in hazard areas.
Yeah, well, because you think you're trying to cut costs, right? But what's going to cost more, doing something right the first time and being prepared when something happens, right? Of course, when something goes wrong, people are going to say, well, this is a freak disaster. How could have we known? Well, in every instance, they could have known.
Yeah. This is part of the thing that comes with being an engineer is sometimes it's easy to say, how could we have predicted this? But it is our job to predict the scenarios and design for them. And it is very important that we consider situations of disaster that and how they can occur and how they can line up. Mm-hmm. That's the story. I mean, the good news is that a lot of those lessons learned have been applied to other land reclamation projects. So the Hong Kong airport is by far a success because of the things that we learned from the Kansai airport.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. And I mean, to this day, it's still very controversial, the amount of money that's being spent to keep Kansai airport afloat. Like I said, $14 billion in the original investment, and already almost half has been added in remediation and expansion. So it's ongoing. It's also becoming one of the more expensive airports for airlines to fly into because they do have to up the fees to try to compensate for the cost. Yeah.
Well, there you go.
That's our first vertical infrastructure talk. And I hope I got through it sounding somewhat intelligent.
Yeah, I think that this was educational. And to all of our listeners, aren't you glad that you stuck around?
That's all from me. And I don't think you have any questions, do you?
No.
No. Well, if you guys have any questions or if you want to correct me on any of the things that I've talked about here, I would be more than happy to read all your messages. Please reach out to us via our social media. We are on Instagram at Measured in Metric. We are on Twitter at Measured in Met. And on Facebook at Measured in Metric.
And you can also find us at measuredinmetric.com.
Thank you so much for listening to us. Thank you for sticking with me while I stumble through the sticky clay situation that this is. I still don't really understand geotechnical engineering. And I hope you understand a little bit more now. And I certainly learned a bit, actually. I'm really glad that I did research this because I had not thought about this topic at all since university. So this is very interesting.
Well, I have not thought about this topic at any point in my life until now. So,
well, I hope you all learned something and maybe take a little bit of time to appreciate the environment around you, the built area around you, and maybe what have gone into keep you safe and make your lives a little bit better and appreciate the engineering that has gone on around you. And remember to always measure in metric.